All right, how are you guys this morning? Good? Tired? I can relate with those of you who are tired. I mean, freshman campout was a blast, but being on it, being on freshman campout from the leader side of things was definitely a big change of pace. it was a good time, though. Got to know a lot of you upcoming freshman guys, which is really good. A little bit to some of you upcoming freshman girls as well. It was an honor and a pleasure and a blessing to really be away with you guys this past weekend. As you guys can see, this is our fifth message in our Leadership in Life series, walking through the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. But before I really begin that, I just want to share like a quick little experience I had yesterday. So yesterday, actually, I got to spend the morning in D.C. with one of my friends from school. He's from Texas, and he's majoring in international relations. That's him on the right there. And we just kind of hung out at the Museum of the Bible. I'd never been. How many of you guys have been to the Museum of the Bible before? Okay, so a lot of you. So, I mean, it was my first time. I just got to walk around with him. He had been there like about a year ago. So he just kind of took me around, showed me all the cool places. And this is in the room where they have like all the different like languages the Bible is translated to and how far along they are in progression. And I was like, that's a really cool place to grab a photo. Let's grab a photo there. So yeah, his name's Jackson. He's a major in international relations. So he's in like politics and government and all that kind of stuff. He's working for, if any of you guys know, Louis Gohmert, House of Representatives from Texas. Probably not, but anyway, that's what he's been doing, just kind of like little errand type of stuff primarily. But he said he's gotten to see some really cool places. He's been in the Library of Congress a few times. He said the only places he hasn't really been is, I believe it was the White House and the Supreme Court, because they've been like shut down recently. But it was good to see him again. I guess we're just having some problems with the slides, so bear with us as we get that figured out. Our computer is slowly dying. All right, I mean we're gonna need it relatively soon, because I do want to open with this is the first message that we're gonna talk primarily out of 2 Samuel. We've kind of gone through all of 1 Samuel. We've talked about the rise of Saul. Saul's rise to power, and then his failure last week with which Casey Veach was, he delivered a great message last week. So give it up for Casey. And now as we enter into 2 Samuel, we're going to start with David's kind of continued rise to power after Saul was killed in battle. So if the slides are up and running, then I would love to get that overview, Bible Project overview of 2 Samuel for us. If not, then we can come back to it in a little bit, maybe.
Maybe.
I'll give it like another few, like another minute or so, maybe. I tested it earlier and it worked. We appreciate our tech people. We really do. Especially when stuff like this goes wrong. All right, cool. There it is. Enjoy the video. We'll have a table question after.
On 1 Samuel, where we were introduced to the book's three main characters, Samuel, Saul, and David, and then also to the book's literary design, which first introduced Samuel and then traced the rise and fall of King Saul in contrast to the rise of King David. 2 Samuel tells the story of David as Israel's king, and in two movements. There's a season of success and a blessing, followed by a huge moral failure and then its sad consequences. And then the book ends with this well-crafted conclusion that reflects back on the good and the bad in David's life, generating hope for a future king to come from his line. So 2 Samuel picks up after Saul's death, and David surprises everyone by composing this long poem where he laments the death of the very man who tried to murder him. And so once again, the author, he's presenting David's humility and compassion. He's a man who grieves the death even of his own enemies. After this, David experiences a season of success and God's blessing. All of the Israelite tribes, they come to David, and then they ask him to unify all the tribes as their king. And so the first thing David does as king is to go to the city of Jerusalem. He conquers it, and he establishes it as Israel's capital city, which he renames as Zion. And from there, David goes on, and he wins many battles and expands Israel's territory. Now, after making Jerusalem the political capital of Israel, he wants to make it their religious capital as well. And so he has the Ark of the Covenant moved into the city. And then in 2 Samuel 7, he tells God, now that Israel has a permanent home, he thinks that God's presence should also get a permanent house. So he asks if he can build a temple for the God of Israel. But God says to David, thank you for that thought, but actually I'm going to build you a house, a dynasty. Now, 2 Samuel 7, this is a key chapter for understanding the storyline of the whole Bible, because God here makes a promise to David that from his royal line will come a future king who's going to build God's temple here on earth and set up an eternal kingdom. And it's this messianic promise to David that gets picked up and developed more in the book of Psalms and also in the books of the prophets. And it's this king that gets connected to God's promise to Abraham. The future messianic kingdom will be how God brings his blessing to all of the nations. And it's right here, in the midst of all this divine blessing, that things go horribly wrong. David makes a fatal mistake. Not fatal for him, but for a man named Uriah, one of David's prized soldiers. So from his rooftop, David sees Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, bathing. David finds her, he sleeps with her, gets her pregnant, and then he tries to cover the whole thing up by having Uriah assassinated and then marrying her. It's just horrible. So when David's confronted by the prophet Nathan about all of this, he immediately owns up to what he's done. He's broken, he repents, he asks God to forgive him, and God does forgive him, but God doesn't erase the consequences of David's decisions. And so as a result of this horrible choice, David's family, his kingdom, it all falls apart. And it makes this section a tragic story, much like Saul's downfall. So David's sons end up repeating his own mistakes, but in even more tragic ways. So Amnon sexually abuses his sister Tamar, and then their brother Absalom finds out about all of this and has Amnon assassinated. And then Absalom goes and he hatches the secret plan to oust his father David from power, and he launches this full-scale rebellion. And so for a second time, David is forced to flee from his own home and go hide in the wilderness, except this time he is not an innocent man. The rebellion ends when David's son is murdered, when it breaks David's heart. And so once again, he laments over the very man who tried to kill him. David's last days find him back on his throne, but as a broken man, he's wounded by the sad consequences of his sin. The book concludes with a well-crafted epilogue, with stories that are out of chronological order, but they have this really cool symmetrical literary design. So the outer pair of stories come from earlier in David's reign, and they compare the failures of Saul and then of David, and how each of them hurt other people through their bad decisions. The next inner pair of stories are about David and his band of mighty men who went about fighting the Philistines. And what's interesting is that both sections have a story of David's weakness in battle. So in contrast to the victorious David of chapters 1 through 9, here we see a vulnerable David who's dependent on others for help. The center of the epilogue has two poems that act like memoirs, and David reflects back on his life. And he remembers times when God graciously rescued him from danger. And he sees these as moments where God was faithful to his covenant promise to him and to his family. Both poems conclude by looking back onto the hope of God's promise of a future king who will build that eternal kingdom. Now, these poems and then God's promise also connect back to Hannah's poem that opened the book. And so these key passages from the beginning, now the middle, and the end of the book bring the book's themes all together. Despite Saul and David's evil, God remained at work, moving forward his redemptive purposes. And God opposed David and Saul's arrogance, but he exalted David when he humbled himself. And so the future hope of this book reaches far beyond David himself. It looks to the future, to the messianic king who will one day bring God's kingdom and blessing to all of the nations. And that's what the book of Samuel is all about.
All right, so there will be a table question up there in a second. Go ahead and take a few minutes to talk about that question up there. All right, let's bring it back in. Don't want to give you guys too much time for that. It's just kind of conversation starter for that one. All right, so I'm going to open up with a story that, like, you might feel like it doesn't really connect at all at the start, but I promise I do have a point with this. I know where I'm going with this. So how many of you guys are familiar with Ludwig on YouTube? Ludwig? No, not a lot of you guys. Some of you guys? Okay. How many of you guys are familiar with Mr. Beast? A lot more of you? Okay. He's friends with Mr. Beast. Think of it that way. So you can see his profile on the screen there. Pretty big. At one point was the fastest growing streamer on the internet. And he made this video that I put in the slide called "I Made a Secret YouTube Channel to Prove It's Not Luck." And basically the entire premise of this video is whether or not it's primarily luck or primarily skill to start a YouTube channel from scratch. And he did it with the restriction because he was look at his channel banner. He's already got 3 million subscribers. He self-imposed a challenge to do it without his former name and branding. So that involved like paying for editors and paying for a voiceover and all of that. And in essence, this video is trying to answer the question, can I influence how successful I am on YouTube? So at the beginning of the video, he calls up Mr. Beast, and he says to him, like, my goal is to get 1,000 views in about 24 hours. So like that's the kind of goal that I've set for myself to be able to, really, if I do it the right way, then I should be able to achieve this goal. And Mr. Beast's response to him when Ludwig asks, would you say it's primarily luck or primarily skill to get big on YouTube? Mr. Beast says it's 99% skill. If you know what you're doing, you could do that 100%. So what Ludwig did is he created a video, and it was a good video too. I've seen this video. You can see I've watched it all the way through. I saw the original video that the video is about. The video is about educating the watcher about what the sitcom entrance is and what an open door policy is through a platform that they would recognize. He used another big streamer to kind of like hook his audience in. In other words, he made a quality, worthwhile video that would, yeah, it's fun to see big people that they recognize, but it also like teaches them something about like a real phenomena that people use and is useful in the film world. He made a custom thumbnail and description, shared some tips about like changing file names to work with the YouTube algorithm and stuff, and then also donated to the streamer who the video was about to kind of get a little more publicity. And obviously, we don't always have like that kind of resources, but his point is that like he followed a certain set of practices in order to potentially get big on YouTube, right? And so after the streamer finished watching the video, it was only like a 4-minute video, he watched the whole thing. Ludwig went to the YouTube analytics page to check how the video was doing. And I'd like to remind you that Ludwig's goal was to get 1,000 views in 24 hours. The video reached almost 1,000 views, 350 likes, and 120 comments after the first few minutes. After about 4 days, the video reached about 11,600 views, and the channel was a bit shy of 1,000 subscribers. The video is still up now, about 8 months later, with over 1 million views, and the channel has around 87,500 subscribers. And that is still the only video on that channel. So why did I tell this story? I tell this story because here Ludwig sets a good example to show others how they also might find success on YouTube. And in the same way, in the context of our Leadership in Life series, David, in the beginning of 2 Samuel, during his success period that we saw in the overview of the book, David does the exact same thing for us as he rises to power after Saul. And I think as I was kind of digesting this text, I saw like three key things that David really does to exemplify how to become successful leaders, even if we're not like naturally built for leadership. So the first theme the first theme that I kind of picked out is that David chose to honor God in his actions and decisions. And you can see that up there. The first thing he does is after basically Saul dies in battle at the end of 1 Samuel, this Amalekite comes to him and tries to bribe him. David doesn't fall for it. And immediately after that, David goes and writes this kind of, well, he doesn't write it, but he laments over Saul's death, the very man who tried to kill him, as the Bible Project very nicely pointed out for us. And he did this even despite knowing that God had selected him to be the king, like pretty much midway through Saul's reign. You can see, I'm not going to read all of this, but some of the repetitive themes throughout this lamentation are some of the underlying things, how the mighty have fallen. Like David, it makes it very clear, David viewed Saul as a mighty warrior, a mighty leader, a strong leader. There, the shield of the mighty was defiled. David respects Saul's power position, even though he was threatened with his life. Saul and Jonathan, he says they were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Again, just another sign of recognizing Saul's great, great leadership potential and the power that he had. And then he commands his people to weep over Saul's death. Like this is again just showing David's like respect for the position Saul was in, and that God had chosen Saul to rule over the people, and that this is a very, very sad thing for Israel to be going through right now. Again, how the mighty have fallen. So yeah, even despite knowing that God had selected him as the succeeding king of Israel back a while ago, David still chooses to honor God by saying, "This is the man that you put in place. This death is tragic, and we need to mourn over this evil that has been committed." The next thing he does, though, in the very next chapter, is that he turns to God for direction. He doesn't do what the Israelites did. Don't pull that slide up yet, but as immediately after he ends his lamentation, David turns and inquires of the Lord and says, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" Just basically like, where am I going to go? What am I going to do next? Saul's dead. I'm your guy now. Like, what am I supposed to do? And he asks again, "To which shall I go up?" After the Lord says to him to go up into the cities of Judah. But right from the start, like I want to highlight, right from the start, David is a man who recognizes that God is number one. God is the man in control. And we'll see a little bit later that David continues to recognize this even after he's been crowned king by his own people. And I want to compare this with what the elders of Israel did in the beginning of 1 Samuel when Lee talked about that I know it was a number of weeks ago. But in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, the elders of Israel come together and ask for a human king. And they do this, like, I remember one of the big things that Lee emphasized was that they did not consult God about this. Like, they gathered together and decided amongst themselves without consulting what God had wanted in store for them. It says, "Then all the leaders of Israel gathered together and basically said to Samuel, 'Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations.'" They didn't consult God. This was their own idea. In the same way, going back to David now, in the same way, in chapter 5, David consults God when questioning whether to go to battle against the Philistines. It says, "Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim, and David inquired of the Lord." There's that phrase again. David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And David came to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood." Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal Perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. Next slide. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim, the same place. And when David inquired of the Lord again, he said, "You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And David did as the Lord commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer. So I read that out because this is example of back-to-back like invasions. And David does the same thing both times. He turns to God the first time and God says, go up. So he goes up, fights the Philistines head on, wins because the Lord is with him and the Lord delivers them into his hand. The second time I think is a little more interesting because it could have been really easy for him to be like, okay, I mean, we just defeated them. God is with us. Let's just do the same thing and we're probably going to win, right? But instead, he stays dedicated to turning to God for direction and honoring God with his decisions and his actions, because the Lord does have something different for him this time. He says, don't go up, go around behind them and pull like an ambush attack. Especially like with these crazy instructions, like what would David have been thinking when God told him to listen for marching in the tops of treetops? That's not a very, I wouldn't think that's a very common military strategy. I think Mark could provide some input on that. Even when he receives instructions that are like kind of out there, like wacky, right? Like David says, I am going to stay committed to the Lord's instruction and I am going to obey the Lord my God. And because of that, God delivers the Philistines into his hand yet again. And once again, I'd like to contrast this with what the Israelites did previously against the same army, mind you, the Philistine army in 1 Samuel chapter 4, where the people, as Lee talked about a number of weeks ago, they just kind of threw the Ark of the Covenant out as a trophy. Like, if we have this, then we're going to win, right? Because that means God's with us. He's with us literally in our presence. They say, let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. And because of their foolishness, they were defeated in battle. So as a result of David's faithfulness that we've seen time and time again now throughout the beginning of his rise to kingship, God ultimately blesses David. This is what the video was talking about in chapter 7. God blesses David and promises to establish a heavenly kingdom by a messianic king through David's line. And that king we know now is Jesus. If we could get 2 Samuel 7 up there. God says, "I will. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity," which that signals to me that this is probably about Solomon, not so much about Jesus, "I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me." And then this, I think, is when he starts to shift back to talking about maybe it's a little bit of both Solomon and Jesus, but I think the more Jesus kind of looking to the messianic king example, not example, but like perspective a little bit. He says, "Your throne shall be established forever." And sure enough, we can see if we cross-reference Matthew 1, I didn't include all of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, but you can see that Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, so on. Skip a few verses, you come down and you see David's thrown in there in the mix in verses 5 and 6. And then you get all the way down to verse 16 and you see Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So, and this is the literal fulfillment of God's promise to David to establish that messianic king and have it come through David's line. So I think in my own life, when I think about this a little bit, one of the first things that comes to my mind always is how unsure I was about applying to college and picking ultimately what college I went to. I mean, as you guys know, I'm at Wheaton College right now. Go Wheaton. I love you, Sarah. but I don't think I've told this story ever really in front of a group. I only applied to two schools. I applied to Wheaton College in Chicago, Illinois, and I applied to Calvin University near Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I received acceptance letters from both of them. So it was a lot of kind of like back and forth about like research and thought and prayer and asking other people's opinions about where I was going to go, because they both seemed like pretty good options. I was interested in medical at the time, not so much anymore now, which is another reason why I'm glad I chose Wheaton. But this went on for quite a few months. And ultimately, I chose Wheaton in like late February, early March of what would this have been, 2021, last year. And honestly, I didn't know whether I made the right decision or not. Like I did the Wheaton, like, I accept my offer thing, and I was just kind of sat there for like a few months, really, until about July, wondering like, okay, I guess I'm going to college. Like, I don't really feel any strong opinions about it. And that was honestly a tough thing to wrestle with, because I am very much like, I want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing, that I'm where God wants me to be. And it was hard not knowing that for a while. And then summer camp hit last year. I was a graduate last year. So it was my last summer camp as a student. And God rewarded me with such an unbelievable like experience last year. Don't get me wrong, I'm excited for this year, but I don't think, for me personally, I don't think anything is going to top what I experienced last year. Between hearing our speaker, Nate, I forget what his last name is.
Nate Crew,
thank you so much. Between hearing him speak about the life of Moses, Strong as Ever was our theme last year. I'm sure you guys know that. But between hearing him speak, all the quiet times that we were having, constantly being in the Word, and then these other books and excerpts of books that I was reading for classes that I, one specific class that I was preparing before the start of the semester, I had never seen so many resources at my disposal weave together so elegantly. And that is really when I knew that I was going to where God wanted me to be. Just between like seeing one book impact my life at summer camp and then seeing that how it connected over here and with this other thing up here, like it just blew my mind, and I had never experienced anything like it. So I, from that point on, I was just so thrilled to go and I definitely understand that I am in the right place where God wants me to be. I've met a lot of great friends. I've had a lot of great professors, a lot of good relationships there. And I am thrilled to go back in August eventually, which Sterling is not very happy about. Love you, bro. So how might this kind of, now that I've shared a little bit for me, how might this look like for you guys? I don't know if they still have these, but do they still do like See You at the Poll kind of events? They do? Okay. For those of you who don't know, See You at the Poll, like you get there, you get to school like about a half an hour early, you meet by your flagpole, and you guys just, I was homeschooled, so I never really went to one, but from what I understand, like you guys just have a time of prayer. Pray for your school, pray for your friends, pray for those around you, pray for your teachers, and just obeying God's commands and being like, I'm going to set time aside early in the morning. I know, how many of you guys are night people? I'm a night person as well. I do not like getting up in the morning. But getting up that little bit extra early, getting to school early and being like, I'm gonna take time out of my day to really like pray and care about the people that are around me. Again, like you can also do this just with a friend you're kinda close with or really close with. Get to know how they're actually like how they're really doing. I know it's easy a lot, especially as a guy, like I tend to notice I do this a lot. I do like the hey, how are you doing like greeting kind of thing. To which you always just reply like, good, how are you, right? But to really like get past that like first layer and be like, no, how are you actually doing? Like, is there any way like I can care? Is there any way I can pray for you? And then those can lead to like some pretty like revealing stuff as to what's going on in people's lives. So I would definitely encourage you guys to really care for your friends in that way as well. And then lastly, just kind of, if you ever see like the kid, I know this is very hard, and I would never have wanted to do this myself, but I really challenge you guys to like, if you see the kid that never has a partner when making a group project or sitting at a lunch table alone, and I know that sounds like a cliche like challenge, and I don't have a slide for this, but I want to encourage you guys with what it says in 2 Samuel chapter 9, when David calls in Mephibosheth, who is Jonathan's son. Now, while it's like, yeah, that's Jonathan's son, like that's easy for him, Mephibosheth was lame in both feet. He would not have been able to do much. He would not have been very high status at all. and definitely like someone that no king would have wanted to be associated with. So David to take that step, yes, he was Jonathan's son, but even for David to take that step and be like, hey, I want to care for you, like, I don't, like, and again, at that time, like, not many people would have done that, especially a person in, like, very, very high power. So kind of, I want to challenge you guys with that. And I believe I have some table questions up there. Yeah, all right. So if you guys want to take a minute or two, going to try to keep it short, speed it up because I'm running low on time already. But yeah, take a minute. Maybe talk about one of those questions. Let's bring it back, guys. Still got a lot of ground to cover. Hopefully these next few sections should go a little bit faster. That was definitely the chonkiest section, if you will. Hopefully we'll get these next few. I want it to leave an impact, but we're going to kind of go a little bit faster through them. So the second theme I really noticed as I was looking through digesting this passage is that David really understood where his people were coming from. David knew his flock. And I mean, quite literally, David understands the civilian perspective because he was one of them before being anointed king over Israel. You can see in 1 Samuel 16, I've underlined the youngest is keeping the sheep because that's what he was doing. He was a shepherd boy. He was just a regular guy. And then obviously God's plan for him was that he would be a great example and a great leader. But David understands how his people feel because he was one of them when he was younger. David also would have had it worse than any of them because I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be tried to be killed by an army of like 3,000 people, whatever it was. Aaron Reed's message from a few weeks ago, he went extensively into David's relationship with Saul and how David was gracious to Saul in that. And then even after becoming king, David participates in public matters and celebrations. He doesn't forget. What his culture or his because of his newfound position. I don't know if I'll read as much of this. I'll start in verse 5. And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord. This is as they're bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into Israel. Was celebrating before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. So it's this big celebration. They're really thrilled to bring the Ark of the Covenant finally back into Jerusalem and make it the capital of both the political capital and the religious capital of the nation. And of course, this is after Israel comes to David and is united under him. I'm going to touch on verses 6 to 11 real quick. I don't have a slide for it, but it's important for context. As they're bringing the ark back, they have it on this kind of cart. They're not like carrying it like they normally do. And the oxen that are pulling the cart stumble a little bit. One of the sons of the guy who, Abinadab, the person whose house they were keeping it at before, his son Uzzah reaches out and touches the ark to kind of like steady it to prevent it from falling. And God doesn't like that. His ark is holy. He wants to keep it holy. So he strikes Uzzah dead on the spot. David gets all upset because their celebration has been rudely, not rudely, but like pretty drastically interrupted. And then David starts to get afraid because he's afraid that God's punishment for Uzzah will extend onto his kingdom. So he ships the ark off to the house of Obed-Edom, who's a Gittite, which that means, scholars believe means originally a Philistine, kind of living with the Israels. But he's also a Levite. He's from the house of Levi. Tribe of Levi, and his house is blessed by God while it stays there about 3 months or so. So now if we can pick up in verse 12, awesome, thank you. And it was told to King David, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the Ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. And just because David is the king doesn't mean that he forgets his culture, his tradition. He's out there with the people, like celebrating the return of the Ark into the city of Jerusalem. He's thrilled just as much as they are. And he's out there with them, like, I imagine it would have just been like if I'm coming up to Will and I'm just like, hey, like, we just got our big, what would we have in common? Like, I don't know what you, like, it's like if I go up and share like a donut with him, right? Like,
yeah,
be like, love you, Will. obviously much more upscale and hype about it, but yeah. And the key thing I want to emphasize that I've already emphasized, but it's David is doing it with the people of Israel. He doesn't like separate himself. And he does the same thing with his military. Again, I don't have a slide for this, but throughout all of chapter 8, kind of details like all the battles he goes through and all his victories. And while it's an epic read, like you guys should definitely go read it if you're interested in seeing how those battles go. But David is battling with his army and doesn't really just hide on his throne while he waits for his soldiers to kind of go off and do his bidding. And while this was a common practice, it still enabled David to kind of develop like a relationship with some of his soldiers that he otherwise wouldn't have had. There are some things that like only people who are fighting with each other would be able to understand and relate to. So kind of a modern example of knowing your flock, I think, is the relationship between a boss and an employee. Presumably in most jobs, the boss would have originally been in the employee's position. And so long as the employee is willing to establish that a good relationship with his boss, the boss will be able to best enable, to promote the employee and figure out how to best utilize the skill set that he brings to the table. So I want to leave this section for you guys with a challenge. Upperclassmen, think back to when you went underclassmen. That may have been 1 year ago, 2 years ago, however long it was. Think back to when you were an underclassman. Underclassmen, think back to when you were in junior high. Leaders, think back to when you were in high school. Having once been in their shoes and knowing their needs, how can you best serve them? We're not gonna take a bit to talk about it, but I want you guys to like meditate on that. Is like come up with maybe like one or two ways to really think about that and be like, how can I serve the people who I've had experience in their realm, and how do I best like talk to them, comfort them, enable them as we both continue to move forward. The final theme that really struck me as I was reading through the beginning of 2 Samuel is that God gave David the proper skill set and gifts to lead his people well. Once again, I want to emphasize that David was a shepherd boy before being selected by God to become king. And Israel, as they unite under David in chapter 5, they remind him of this. Chapter 5. They say to him, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. In times past when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.'" So the tribes of Israel are coming to him and being like, "We want you as our king, but we want to remind you of what God said. And a little bit about your past." And because ultimately, like that's part of what helped made David a great leader. He already knew his flock because he was an ordinary dude, and the people want to remind him of that, be like, "Hey, remember us." The other thing is that David willingly identifies as a prince. If we go to chapter 6, after David is rejoicing in when the Ark of the Covenant is brought in, one of his wives, Michal, comes up and basically is like, "Hey, I didn't like what you were doing." And David basically says to her, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father." Michal was one of Saul's daughters. "Chose me above your father and above his house to appoint me as prince over Israel," not king, prince. David understands that God is still in control. David is second in command, and he understands that. God is number one. God is the real king. And this does apply to us just like it does to David. I have a bunch of slides with verses on them. That we'll kind of speed through real fast. Ecclesiastes 4 says, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil." Skip down to verse 12. It says, "And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." God shapes us through our friends who we choose to hang out with, commune with, spend time with. And choosing your friends, guys, is really, really important. 1 Corinthians says, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. If you guys, there's nothing wrong. Let me put it this way. It is not bad to go and have non-Christian friends, hang out with non-Christian, because we are called to love our non-Christian friends and bring them to salvation. But if that's all who we hang out with and we're influenced by them, and they start going into things and paths that we disagree with or we don't like, the more we spend time around them, the more likely we are to also get sucked into those things, even if we're like, I would never let myself get sucked into like drugs or even sex, right? God also shapes us through our family and upbringing. Ephesians 6 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, honor your father and mother, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Shapes us through our circumstances. Romans 8:28. I know that's a very popular one. But we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. God shapes us through the gifts he gives us as well. This is the 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 12 is a very, very influential chapter for this portion. And he's, basically what this is saying is that we have a bunch of different gifts. We're given a bunch of different gifts by God, but they're all given to us by the same God. It's not like God the Holy Spirit gave me, I don't know, like, I'll say leadership because I do believe I actually have some leadership gifts. And it's not like he gave Will, like, a more upbeat spirit and gave me, like, a more downcast spirit, right? It's not like he gave the other Will Dillingham, it's not like he gave him, like, the gift of athleticism and he gave me the gift of, or and some other God gave me the gift of, I don't know, like, maybe, it would be a good one.
Checkers,
music. We'll go with music. How about that? a little more of a different contrast. It's all the same God who's giving us these gifts. All these are empowered by one and the same Spirit who apportions to each one individually as he wills. There's a reason why God makes us all different, so we can continue to mold and shape others and challenge each other in our faiths. Point out each other's weaknesses, point out each other's strengths, and come together to work on them and sharpen them. And lastly, through our personalities and character traits, 1 Corinthians 12:14-22. This is the whole parts of the body kind of example that Paul gives. And I want to highlight verses 18, 19, and 20. It says, but as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. And this very much ties into what I just talked about with the gifts he gives us. Our different personalities are very essential to encouraging one another, pushing one another, challenging one another. As I mentioned, I believe I've always had some sort of leadership tendencies and traits, some gifts. And I think being the oldest child for me, like my upbringing, right? We talked about our family and our upbringing. I believe being placed as the oldest child in my family has really allowed me to practice those traits and try to be a good example for my younger brother and my younger sister. It's just a personal example, man. So now I want to turn to you guys and have you guys think about it for a little bit. There will be last few table questions. I know we're running late, but we'll use this as kind of like a transition and take a few minutes to talk about these last few questions.